away. And fortunately, I didn't, because a lot of that stuff is in this film, and it's a very informative film, and it's historical. It kind of gives you an insight into how the progress of the thing came along. But anyhow, I came out of the woodwork, so to speak, so that I could gradually try in my own way to bring my dad back to the fore. I've heard people say, well, who's Dr. Bob? Well, who is he? That's what we want to find out. So we're gradually getting to the place where we can really say that young people coming in today are very interested in Dr. Bob. They have heard about Bill for, 38 years now since Dad has died, and they are the only founder really that they know. But there's always the inquisitive ones that say, well, hey, there were two of these guys. So that's what we want to get. We want to get the two of them back together. We don't want to leave one out. We don't want to leave the other one out. So anyhow, I was an adopted child. I was adopted when I was 5 years old. And somebody from California told me that I was picked just to be a part of this program, and I should be proud of it, and I am proud of it. It's been a lot of fun just seeing all these different miracles that have happened. You wouldn't believe some, well, maybe you would, you have all worked with them. But there are some people that you would just say, you'd look at them and say, no way, no way. And my dad, if he saw that there was one like that, that would not cooperate enough to take the program, he wouldn't fool with him. He didn't wet nurse him, because there were too many that did want the program. So that's what he did. He says, well, you go do it your way for a while longer, and when you get desperate enough, why, come back, we'll talk to you. He didn't throw him out completely. I mean, he left the door open. But anyhow, we all know how Dad and Bill met, but I'd like to say here that we owe a lot of debt to a lot of non-AAs. We owe debt to a man named Dr. Tunks, who was a minister who gave Bill Wilson the list of names. No, he gave him the name of Norman Shepherd. And Norman Shepherd was going out of town that day, and he gave Bill a list of names. And on the bottom of that list was Henrietta Seiberling. And so Henrietta and Mother, and this is how things interweave and work together. And it was providential, or it wouldn't have happened. But they were very close through the Oxford group. So they did get Dad to go to the Oxford group meetings, and he liked these people's poise, and he tried to follow, and did pretty much follow the program, except he would get drunk every night, and he couldn't figure out why until Bill came, and he had missed the idea of service. So later on, he whittled the 12 and 12 down to love and service. But anyhow, at Mother's invitation, after Bill, well, we owe the Oxford group a lot of debt, because they furnished the first meeting place for us. And I say us, I'm not really one of them, but I'm really not in any one of the three categories, but I consider myself in all of them. I take credit for being the first Alateen, because I'm the oldest. And of course, my brother is the next one. But anyhow, the Oxford group, you know, had the four absolutes: absolute love, absolute honesty, absolute purity, and absolute unselfishness. And that is a tough row to go. It's a 24-hour day job, but it will work, and it will pan out for you. And after Bill came, Mother invited Bill to stay with us, and he stayed with us for 3 months. And they would talk and talk until 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. They'd be back up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and that is where all of the basic parts of the first 165 pages of the book were formed, right in our kitchen. And when they got to be 4 years old, they started counting noses, and there were 40 that had been sober and had never slept one way or another. I mean, they stayed sober. So they decided, well, maybe they ought to have a guideline. So 4 years to the day almost that they met, they came up with the big book. And before they did that, they had a lot of the, not a lot of them, we had, I think, 28 stories in that book from the Akron area. And we had a lot of those people around our dining room table working with Jim Scott, who was an alcoholic and also an author. He worked for the Beacon Journal at one time, and they practically dragged him off of the street. But he turned out to be a good person and really helped a lot with this book. And I was going to business college at that time. One of the boys had a brother-in-law that had a business college, and he was so grateful that his wife's brother was sober finally that he paid my way to go to business college free. So that's how I was there to type up some of the stories. And some of the boys were asked to write them, and they wouldn't write them. They thought they should be paid for the stories. And I have never really quite figured out to this day where royalties really go to, because many people wrote that book. It wasn't one person or two persons. It was many people that wrote that book. But anyhow, as long as it got in the hopper and got used, I think that was the main thing. But anyhow, they finally called the hospital they did get another fella from the minister who had an Oxford group meeting down at his church, and he had a lot of problems. He had industrial strength problems. He had alcoholism, and he had no money. He had a terrific allergy to tuna fish. And we didn't know that, but whenever he'd have tuna fish, and we had it a lot because that was during the Depression, and it was cheap then. Now, forget it. But in those days, it was very, very cheap, and we would have it in tuna fish salad, or thank goodness Mother never did the tuna fish casserole bit. But anyhow, I don't think I could take that. But she... one time, this Eddie had been thrown out of his house. He and his family, they had two little kids and a little wife. And Ruthie sent the kids on to Grandma in Michigan, and the two of them stayed at our house. Well, Ruth had come down on one of the hottest days of the year, and she'd have something around her throat. Well, we couldn't quite figure that out. So finally, Mom bore in on her, and found out that Eddie was doing a little choking job. So that was worked on, and I guess one of the times when Mother was working on him, when no one else was there, he took after Mom with a butcher knife, and she didn't know what to do, so she just dropped on the kitchen floor and started saying the Lord's Prayer. And finally Eddie stopped, but Eddie was, like I say, he was a case. He ended up going back into an insane asylum in Michigan. And, but you know, they were crushed because that was their first attempt and it was a complete flop. And so they went on to someone else. But when my dad died in 1950, a man came up to my brother and said, "Do you know me?" And he says, "I sure do." He says, "You're Eddie?" And so he says, "Yeah," he says, "I am." And he says, "I've been in the group 1 year, and I'm in the Youngstown group." And he died sober. So you never know when the seed is going to grow. So sometimes I say that because sometimes you work on somebody and you think, "Oh my gosh, no way is that going to work." But again, it'll work. And then the other thing that I think that we have to owe to the Oxford group was the very fact that it gave my mother the desire and constant hope that someday my dad would sober up. And it was just this drive in her through their love and through their program that gave her that strength. And that is another miracle I saw. Now, I'm going to read some of this because it's a direct quote. But about Dr. Bob, the Best of Grapevine, Volume 1, says he was proud, resentful, and that was under his mother's influence. He had a dislike for various people and things. He was self-sufficient, cocky, and selfish. Does that sound familiar to anybody? You don't have to be a drunk to be those things, do you? But anyhow, some of the things were true. They were true. He was a man 6'4", and he wasn't a real heavy man, but he was sort of muscly. He had real steely blue eyes, and boy, when he said something, old Smitty and I jumped. We knew when those blue eyes got bluer, look out, we were in for it. But people would be really scared to death of him at first. He was really stern-looking, but later on, they got to the place where they adored my dad. They just loved him. But he was very loving, and he was compassionate, and he was loyal almost to a fault. And he was humble. And in 1929, he had a new practice. It was the crash. It was the depression. He had this terrific alcoholic problem. He almost lost his home when Roosevelt came along and declared the mortgage moratorium. And if my brother always says that the house reminds you of something of Archie Bunker's house, but it doesn't remind me of Archie Bunker's house at all. And but he later on became pretty normal. He was an avid card player. I mean, he wasn't a gambler. He wouldn't gamble with any of the drunks because he felt that if they lost, that was just another excuse for him to go out to the bar. But anyhow, he had his favorite songs and his favorite movie stars, and he treated drunks in four ways. He treated them physically, physiologically, psychologically, spiritually, and socially. And he treated the whole man because the whole man was sick. And in those days, you know, you only went to the hospital 3 or 4 days, and it was, $6 or $8. My brother says, "I think it's a little more now." But anyhow, he always told the boys that to take out insurance on themselves and go out and give the program away. He says, it didn't cost you, so don't you charge for it. So, and when he was told that he didn't look like a founder, he says, I just work here. He says, he called on 5,000 different people. They called him Mr. 12-Step. And I guess he was. I never really liked the expression. But he got no pay for this. But I say he got no pay, but he did get pay. He got his own sobriety. He got his wife happy again. He got to see many families brought back together. He was just a happier person. He got along with his family better. He got his practice back. And so when you can look at families and you see that the man or the woman, now in the early days, the women were kind of put on hold. Anyhow, they were leading happy, useful lives instead of the kind that they came from. Some of them were full of crime, shame. Sometimes they died, and sometimes they committed suicide. So he saw all these people that were of that nature change into something worthwhile and good. And he quoted, "It will be well for us to concentrate on the goal of personal sobriety and active work." And then he also said that to have been a part of it all from the beginning has been a reward indeed. So he got paid. And we all, he's still talking, we all want love, stability, being humble, and having loyalty. Stability means right mind and the capability to cope now, which is what we can do and what I have seen others do after they took the program. Now, he only had 15 years of sobriety when he left us, and maybe some of you have more than that, I don't know. But anyhow, he really left us a legacy. And he that was his legacy that he left us. And there is a book out called Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Now, I have no monetary interest in that. I have a very great personal interest in it because it's a story of the early closeness. And the man that wrote the book really did his homework. And he didn't get to see the book published. He died 3 months, I think, before it was published, and it was presented in the at the conference in New Orleans in, I think it was 1980. But anyhow, it is a book that I think all of you would like. It's an easy book to read, and Bob Pearson, I don't know whether I should mention his name or not. He's not, I suppose if they're not dead, am I? But anyhow, he wrote or told my brother that was the only book that GSO published that they didn't bitch about, and that was his words, not mine. That's what he said, that they that was the only book that they never squawked about. So anyhow, we split up with the Oxford group meeting at T. Henry's home. And some of them went to Cleveland, and you know, they say all you need for a new group is a resentment and a coffee pot. And in those days, they had quite a few coffee pots and resentments too. But we met then at our home. One time we had 75 people in our home. We had them in the living room, we had them in the dining room, we had them in the kitchen, we had them on the front steps. We had them going up the steps to the second floor, and there were 75 people there, and that house just bulged. So after two of those, they decided they should have another meeting place. So that's when they got King's School. And but when they published the book, they published 5,000 of that first printing, and they didn't have any money to sell them. They sent so many of them to physicians, and that cut down on the profit, and they printed it on real old paper, because it was, you know, just during the war time, and they did it on old paper because they figured that the people would think they were more for their money, that the book was thicker, and that paper made them thicker. But it, the text of that book is the same today as it was then, and I don't know of any other book that has that same value of the same ideas that still work. I mean, you take a kid's math book now, so much different. I couldn't even attempt to try it myself. But this book is the same as it was 50 years ago, almost 50 years ago. Well, we had a little bit of publicity. We had the Liberty article in 1939 and the Plain Dealer article by Elric Davis. And then we had the Jack Alexander article in the Saturday Evening Post, and that really brought in the responses. And then Raleigh Hemsley was a member of the Oxford Group with us. And the Oxford Group wanted to take credit for Raleigh getting sober. Well, Raleigh objected to that, and he made them retract that statement. Now, Raleigh Hemsley, in case you don't know, was a baseball player with the Cleveland Indians, and he was a catcher, and they say he was a better catcher sober than most of them were, or drunk than most of them were sober. But the way they got Raleigh to the hospital, they had a person on their own team hit him on purpose, and they hauled him from the field into an ambulance down to the city hospital in Akron. That's how they got Raleigh in the hospital. So anyhow, we have had several conference meetings. We've had them in Cleveland. I was at the first one there. I was there at one in 45. I was there in 1950 when my dad gave his last speech. I was at the St. Louis one in 1955. And then I didn't go to any until the Montreal meeting in 1985. And those two meetings are really the only monetary benefits that my brother and I have had from the GSO office, which is all right. We were just there. But anyhow, with a million people in 114 countries, something had to be right. And the reason I think it turned out right, it was Depression time when it was formed. Nobody had any money. There was a closeness that you don't see today because people are, instead of going to visit each other and hashing things out like that, they're bowling, they're skating, which is nothing wrong with it. And don't get me wrong, I always say there is because there isn't. But in those days, they didn't have the money to do those things. So the next thing was go see the people that gave you the substance to keep on going, and that's what they did. And I just don't think that they would have the closeness and the basis if they hadn't had that first few years of that, with that constant word by word and it was really example by example too. And I just think often the times just what Mom and Dad would think if they could come back and see one of these. If they had been up in Montreal, wouldn't they have been proud? I don't see how they couldn't have been. But anyhow, they finally got a hospital. First of all, we'd put them in our home. And that was when we gave him the paraldehyde and the famous diet of sauerkraut and canned tomatoes and carrot syrup. And they were kind of a hearty bunch. But anyhow, after that, they went to City Hospital in Akron. And then the doctors there got together, the other doctors, and they decided that the hospital was for sick people. So I don't know what they thought the alcoholics were, but to me, they were sick people. And finally, they worked it around. They went to another little clinic. They went to a lot of these drying out places. And they went to state hospitals. And then they finally got over to St. Thomas. And the way they got there was Sister Ignatia had a half-brother who used to drink. And he got drunk, and she would take him. She'd take him into the hospital and would sober him up. So anyhow, she and my dad, she finally inveigled Father Haas to go to a meeting with a couple of the boys, and he was so impressed that he finally gave her permission to have a room to put these boys in, which was the first alcoholic ward in the world that a hospital gave us. And then they worked amazingly well together. They were just, well, they just really jibed. And Sister Ignatia always said that you had two hands. If you put God in one hand and got, AA in the other, you didn't have room for a drink. And she gave medals to the boys, and she always told them to call her before they took a drink and return that medal. And she didn't get very many medals back. First, in those days, you know, you could only go the one time. Now, I'd like to say some words about my mother. I feel in a lot of ways that the program really wouldn't have taken if it hadn't been for her and her constant faith in all of them. And her working with them, working with their families. And I always called Dr. Bob the Rock, and Bill was the promoter, but my mother was the stabilizer. And she was a school teacher at one time, and Bill Wilson and Dad both said in the Best of the Grapevine that for a while she was the mother of AA. And was literally AA for a while. But she kept things on an even keel. She had a way of calming people down. She was understanding, and she was a source of encouragement to many people. And Dad and Bill would get some wild ideas at times. At that time, there was no thought of a hospital like we have today. No thought of it. And you know, in the early days, people, well, they thought we were little nuts. They thought the AAs were little nuts. But she would counsel women. She'd be on the phone in the early days, and she would have several men come in. We didn't have them come in. They came in. They'd be there before we were even out of bed sometimes. We had to go down and let them in, and then we'd go up and get dressed and down and make the coffee. And you could get coffee for £3.29 then, but you had to take up a collection to get the 29 cents. Nobody had any money. And we had cookies. Had a salesman that sold day-old cookies, or sold cookies, and he brought the day-old cookies over. So that was after they had their quiet times. And in case you don't know what a quiet time is, it's where you read the Bible and you pray and you listen for guidance. And Archie Trowbridge has a story in the big book. It's called The Fearful One. And I never have seen a man so downtrodden and so pathetic as that man was. He was, he was about as skinny as this wire, I think. And he was just mentally beat. And he came in the program, took the treatment at the hospital, and he lived with us 10 months. And my mother counseled him, and she really, really gave him the basis for him to finally, after 10 months, to get up his confidence and his courage to go back to Detroit, and he started several groups, and that was Archie. Now, to me, that is another true miracle. So anyhow, I still think that in a way that the way my mother talked to these women at the beginning, she had meetings with the women while the men had meetings at the Oxford group. So in a way, I feel like my mother had a lot to do with Al-Anon. One woman wrote, she had a very deep understanding of the trials and tribulations of others. And another one said, there never seemed to be a striving for self-glory or a setting herself up as an authority. And Fred Barton wrote, after she had been gone 6 months, that this woman with the big heart knew in her soul, here was something that for 19 long years the world had needed, and here now was the answer. The transition from family group to national organization was in vast degree her accomplishment. And another wrote, she was just fun to be with. That's one I like. And seeing her happy again was another miracle that I saw. Yeah, it was a great miracle, because she was at the place where she just felt hopeless. She didn't know what to do. She had two kids, and her husband wasn't sober enough to make a good living. And like I say, he almost lost home. But she got fired up with the Oxford group, and that is what kept her going. So, anyhow, I don't know whether you want to hear any of my story or not. You know, you've heard of near beer, and I kind of think maybe I might have become a near alcoholic, because I had the makeup to be one. I was an adopted child. I always had a kind of a chip on my shoulder. I had a lot of resentment. I was shy, and I just got, you know, I was at the place where I didn't dare. I was just scared to drink. I just figured I had the makeup for it, so I didn't do it. Just to drink ale. You know, ale wouldn't hurt anybody, right? Wrong. Anyhow, I was getting pretty good, and you know that list of things you ask yourself if you're an alcoholic? I was getting so I could answer about five of those. So I thought, well, and I was getting like a balloon. And some people love Robin Hood. I loved Robin Hood ale. But anyhow, with that size I was getting to be, I just decided I was going to give myself a birthday present one day. So I did. I gave myself a birthday present, and I quit. And sometimes I think maybe I should, or I would like, on these hot days especially, that tastes kind of good. But I don't know how close I came to that point of turning over. I mean, you take about 8 16-ounce bottles a day or something like that, you know. I could have been right on the edge. Maybe the next drink I would have taken would have been the one. And I don't want to find out now that it would have been the one. So it's not worth it to me. So I just don't do it. It seems like things come around. You know, I have this friend whose husband was one of the early AAs, and he did a lot of 12-step work. He was the other Ernie G, and my first mistake was Ernie G. My biggest mistake. I don't call Ray a mistake, but this one was the first one of my Ernie G was a mistake. But anyhow, he had his good points. He put a lot of input into the program, but then he let a lot of the boys down, you know. And for years I used to think, this program isn't going to work for my family. I don't know, you know, works for other families. Why doesn't it work for mine? So being a slow learner, I finally got a divorce after 24 years, and I also decided that it wasn't the AA program that wasn't working, it was the worker that wasn't working AA, and that was the way it was. And so anyhow, I think 11 years was about as much as he stayed that way, sober. But then, one time excuse me, in 1947 or so, I got agoraphobia. And so Bill was at the house one time, and he came over, and they sent him over to me, and we talked about 4 hours. And I don't know if you had anybody had agoraphobia or not, but you get afraid to go outside. I got afraid to go to the front door. But Bill came over and we talked a while, you know, and I thought to myself, gee, that might have been just about like Dad and Bill talking, you know. Might have told me about the same thing. It was all having faith and prayer. And so anyhow, after he talked to me that length of time, he says, well, now, Susie, he said, we're going to take a walk. And I said, no, I don't think so, Bill. He said, yeah, we're going to take a walk. So I shook all the way up 2 blocks, and we finally got back. And I heaved a sigh of relief, and I got my wind back. And he says, now you can go by yourself. Well, you talk about falling over, that's about what I did, but I did it. And so then I found out that I could go if I had a car around, you know, if I had a car that I could get back. Then I gradually got to the place where I didn't get the panic. And the way I didn't get the panic was that I asked the higher power not to give me the panic, not to let me get it, to keep me from getting it. And it's just so many different ways that this program can work for a person. You know, I read somewhere here not too long ago that we are all needed, and we all have worth, and that we should all think of the other person and try and help them in either one of those areas. And in I don't know whether any of you have read Nan Robertson's new book or not. There's quite a bit of controversy about it, and I can't quite see why, because heaven knows anonymity has been broken many times. But anyhow, in a very good book on the basics. And as she says, she did not write it for the AA. She wrote it for the other people that thought we were a little cultish. And I think it's a good book myself. But in that book, she says, I can't, he can, let him. And I think that's a good thing to go by. And I think that's about what I've done. So I'm going to give you all a rest now. Any questions? Working?
How old were you when all this
took place? Well, I was 17, and you don't need a computer. I'm 70 now.
How old were you both?
17. We are 4 months different. He, you know, being adopted, we used to have a lot of fun in school with that. We'd tell him our ages. We neglected to tell him I was adopted. And that really threw him. So we had a lot of fun that way. We were ornery kids. We were not always a joy to my mom and dad. My mother started smoking when she was, I think maybe 57, something like that. And during the Depression, she got the idea, you know, these little machines that you roll your own cigarettes in. She got the idea it would be cheaper to do those, you know, than to buy ready-made. Well, Smitty and I were starting to smoke about that time, and so we very benignly asked her if we could roll them for her, which we did, but we put pencil shavings in them, and that way she'd light them up, and I mean, they're lit up. I don't know whether we ever told her that or not, but she said, I don't think these are as good as the store made, so we got our cigarettes back. So my mother was very easily shocked at first when the AAs first came in, but they got her out of it. They got her out of it.
How long was it after the drill and South Carolina got together?
Oh, that was just a matter of maybe a week or so. He hadn't really accepted the program yet. You know, when Bill and Abby talked, Bill got drunk again. And when Bill first came, I think Dad held a little reservation, like, you know, a lot of you do. Not you especially, but a lot of the drunks do that. And they, because he got this terrific thirst, you know, for knowledge. And, of course, on the way, he got another thirst that I don't think he ever got any knowledge from it. He just, I don't think he made a meeting.
You remember that day the day he got back and performed the operation?
Yes. Yep, I was home then.
Hmm? Was it late at night when you got home?
Yeah, he, when you've lived with that, you have to realize this is way before Al-Anon as such, but when you've lived with that for, oh Lord, I don't know how long Mother lived with that, but it was long enough that whenever Dad was over 10 minutes late, the old wheels started, you know, saying, is he, where is he, you know, and it takes a long time to get to the place where you put a lot of trust in them again. There was somebody back there that had a... I cannot hear you. What kind of a home did they have? You mean the ideas for the big book? Well, they did not do it all at once. Book of James and the Bible. They took the Faith Without Works out of that, and they had what was the other one? Yeah, and well, there was about three different things that they took that from, and they what? No, that wasn't in that. I've got it here somewhere. But anyhow, it's Faith Without Works, and it's the, where is it? Varieties of Religious Experiences, and the big book, or the Bible, and seems like it was E. Stanley Jones? There was some other person that they took that from. I should know that, but I can't think of it right now. And then, of course, the stories, they just had to scrounge around until they found people that would, you know, write them. This one fella in the first edition, first printing, his mother saw a copy of the manuscript that he sent out to the physicians. And so she wrote New York and asked for the book. So they sent it to her, And then they decided that he, you know, he wrote back to them all the time. It seemed to be okay, and they decided that he maybe should come to New York. So they sent him the money. They took up a collection and sent him the money to come to New York. Went to meet the train, and he was smashed to the gills. And so they took his story out of the second printing. That was the Lone Endeavor. You'll not find that in any of the other printings. So, but it's been great. It's been a long... It was a long haul at first, but gradually it leveled off. You know, I mean, a lot of these alcoholics have great minds, and they have good ideas. And if they use them right, they are good. And they have done a lot of good. A lot of them have done a lot of damage, but there's been, most of it has been good. And those that did do the damage have damaged only themselves, because they didn't make the program, and heaven only knows what happened to them. I don't know. At least that's the way I look at it now. you get what you put into it. Okay? Well, thank you.
Thank you, Sue. That's special. I just want to take a minute and let you know that Sue and her brother Bob, she refers to him as Smitty. You heard her talk about Smitty earlier. In the process of writing their book, The Story, and it should be out towards the end of this year. Yeah. Okay, February of next year. That will be published through Parkside Publishing Firm, too. So we'll as soon as that comes out, we'll get the word out to you. Sue will be available for a few minutes to autograph books, or just if you want to ask her a personal question, feel free to do that. If there's nothing else, that's it. Thank you all for coming. Good night.